bad things from happening. It just stops you enjoying the good things of life. That's pretty smart. Worrying does not stop bad things happening. It just stops you enjoying the good things of life. So, brilliant little saying there. So, that should be on the next edition of the shopping bags. Where's the shopping bag people? Well, one of the reasons you did have those shopping bags, it's one of the similes which, you know, I've taught for a long time about meditation, about life. That, you know, you have shopping bags, and many of you have been shopping, and many of you just know it's really hard to get out of shopping these days. Even you go to airports, and you've got to go through the you can't get a shortcut through the shopping mall. You know, when you go in, you have to go this way or that way just to go, you know, to the gates. There's always shopping all over the place. So, you see many, many people with all this stuff which they have bought. They get these two heavy shopping bags. And this becomes the little visual exercise you do. So we can start this now, because I said I'd do some more meditation today. So this is first of all exercise in meditation. So if you'd like to get yourselves comfortable, close your eyes. And there we go. There we go. Oh, by the way, if you feel too cold, remember you can always Buddhist climate control. If it's too cold, you keep a warm heart. If it's too hot, you keep a cool head. Thereby, you don't need to waste so much energy with air cons and heaters. So, remember that. When it's a warm day, keep a cool head. When it's a cold day, keep a warm heart. Not a hot head, but a warm heart. Very good. And anyway, if it's really cold, it actually makes you live longer. Because, and it's obvious, it's a science. Do you notice you always put things in the refrigerator to stop them going off and decaying? So the colder it is, the longer you last. Is that true? You know what my secret of long life is? My secret of living to a ripe old age is to drink long life milk. That's what it says, long life milk, so must be the way to... Okay, let's do some meditation, because I think people are falling asleep, that's why they're not laughing at my jokes, or perhaps it's, I'll have to admit that they're not that good jokes, or you've heard them before. Anyway, here we go. So, you're sitting here, eyes closed. Body as comfortable as you can manage. Now, visualize that you're carrying two shopping bags, one in either hand. And you've been carrying those shopping bags for a long time. The one in your left hand, really, really heavy. The one in your right hand, even more heavy. And you've been carrying them for such a long time, your arms ache and your shoulders hurt. They're so heavy. And like many shopping bags, they have the name of the store where you bought the goods. It could be just, I don't know, Louis Vuitton or Mont Blanc, or that's about as much as I know about shops. But anyway, they always have the brand of the shop on the outside of the bag. But this shop, or this bag you're holding in your left hand, has the word or the letters PAST on the outside, because this represents your past. All of the memories, both good and bad, which you have been carrying around for such a long time. And just like a real shopping bag which has been full of so many purchases is so heavy that it makes your arm and shoulder hurt, the bag representing your past, all these memories, that makes your heart ache and your brain very tired. It's exhausted because you've been carrying around that shopping bag full of stuff from the past. All those memories, unfinished business, carrying it around, not being able to let it go. And then you look at the shopping bag in your right arm, right hand. That is also really heavy. And in that shopping bag, or rather on the outside of that shopping bag, is written the six letters FUTURE. That's your future. And all the plans and fears and worries, all of that you pack in and stuff in to the big heavy shopping bag called your future. And you can carry that around for such a long time. Anxiety, worry, even like hopes and plans as well. Carrying them around. So that means that your brain is tired and your heart is just weak from exhaustion, worrying about the future. You can imagine those two heavy shopping bags as if they were real, because you've been carrying shopping bags, and you can imagine that these past and future which you carry around, they also exhaust and tire you. They make you weary. Now, you can visualize focusing just on the shopping bag in your left hand, all the stuff you've been through in your life, been carrying around. Imagine yourself leaning to the left so you can lower, 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 lower that shopping bag onto the ground. And when that shopping bag meets the floor, all the weight, the burden vanishes. The ground carries that burden now. And you can move your fingers away from the handle. Move your left hand and arm to hang loosely by your side so it can relax to the max. You've let go of a shopping bag carrying the past. And then you imagine a shopping bag in your right hand, the future. That too is extremely heavy. So many anxieties and fears and plans. Most things you plan never work out the way you expected anyway. But for now, imagine lowering the shopping bag in your right hand, representing all your future fears and worries. Imagine lowering that to the ground. And when it meets the floor, all the weight, the burden vanishes. And you can move your right hand and arm up by your side to relax and recuperate, to re-energize as you put the future down. And you stand there, relaxing, recovering, with the past and the future in the two big shopping bags, one on either side. And you are standing in this wonderful place between the past and the future, called the present moment. Just staying here, at peace. And don't be concerned about those two shopping bags. No one is going to take them away. They'll be there for you afterwards. But they'll be much lighter because you have rested and re-energized. So this visualization allows you to let go. And what are you left with? This wonderful thing we call the present moment. Just being here, just now. Now you can be aware of your body just to relax it a little bit more. But you find that much of the things, much of the attitude which disturbs the body and makes it tight and tense, is fear of the future or guilt from the past. When you totally let go of the past and the future and you allow yourself to stay in this present moment, that spot between the past and the future, then you find so much which is tiring disappears. Just being here. Not trying to achieve something or go somewhere, just being here. how peaceful are you? How peaceful is your mind, your inner world? See if you can give it a number from 1 to 10. 1 means extraordinarily peaceful. Number 10 means you're quite agitated and restless. So give that a number from 1 to 10. What number would you give? 1 is really peaceful, 10 is agitated. And be honest. This is just one of those skillful means, those tricks, so that you can be aware of something I call the peace-o-meter. I have a speedometer, thermometer. This is a peace-o-meter, by which you can be mindful, aware of how peaceful you are. And what makes your mind more peaceful? What makes it agitated? Once you find out the causes of peace, and the cause which creates restlessness, once you have that feedback, it's quite easy to select that which causes peace in your mind, which creates contentment, at ease, just being, rather than having to achieve something. How does it feel now? How peaceful are you? When the mind becomes peaceful in this moment, the body usually follows. So now it's coming to the end of the meditation. How do you feel? Now just take three more breaths mindfully. Breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, and breathing in, breathing out. At the end of the third breath, you can open your eyes to end the meditation. Three more breaths. Very good. Excellent. So on that meditation, I introduce something which I call the peaceometer. Always like sort of doing something new in meditation, mindfulness, kindfulness, bare awareness, and the peaceometer. Because a lot of times when people are trying to relax, you need to get some feedback. I mentioned this morning, get feedback from your body. Is it relaxing? Is the pain, the tightness getting less or getting more? And so when you're mindful of the right area, you can actually just start to learn. Trial and error, see what works, what makes it more peaceful, what makes it more agitated, more tense. And that's how we learn. It's one thing to say, okay, be kind, let go. But how do we let go? And so, simile of the shopping bags is one thing which you can recognize, you know, how important that is to lower your shopping bags. And the other one was just focus on the right thing. So you can make focus on the breath if you want to do those breath meditations, but your breathing meditation, people get even more tense. Am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? Come on, watch the breath. And I'm not watching the breath. What's happening? But the peaceometer, you can soon get to know how peaceful you are and how agitated you are. That's the first thing, the mindfulness of the right area, like mindful of just, you know, your body, your feelings of tightness somewhere, or pain. And the other one was just how relaxed are you? Or how agitated are you? And so that's why I say give it a number, because that's what we have to do these days. No, we shouldn't really know whether we're hot or whether we're cold, but these days you have to put a thermometer in your mouth to find out. You've got so many like checks. So this is like the peaceometer. So once you can understand what the peaceometer means, and just giving a number from 1 to 10, it's just a skillful means, then how peaceful are you? And with a bit of practice, repeated exercise, you soon get to know how peaceful you are. And the next thing is, what makes you more peaceful? What makes you more agitated? So you actually start to learn the causes of these things. And that's where you start to learn trying to be something you're not makes you more tense, more agitated. And you know, you're trying to sort of get rid of pain when the pain is there instead of allowing it to be. It makes it worse when you try and get rid of things. When you get afraid of things. Or when you sort of get upset and angry at things from the past. That is what makes things worse. You can find yourself getting more tense. So instead you just let it be. Relax to the max. Stop fighting. And then just to be with things. Then you find that things start to relax and heal themselves. You become peaceful. When you're not trying to be peaceful, it's the trying which causes a tension. So, the story of the monster. Kids like these stories of monsters. So, this is one of the teachings which I developed, and now is one of these teachings. Somebody showed it to me. It's some person is doing this on YouTube. The anger eating monster. Because one day there was an empress and she was running her empire. And one day she went away for a day. She came to the Hong Kong University Center of Behavioral Management on a retreat for one day. And while she was away, a big monster came into her palace. Such a big, ugly, frightening monster. And was so terrifying, that the security guards, they hid under the tables, they went into the cupboards, they just disappeared, because they were too frightened to confront the big monster. And that let the monster go right inside the emperor's palace, right into the inner halls of the palace, right into the throne room, and sat on the empress's throne. And at that, the security, the soldiers, even the ministers, they said, "You've gone too far. Get out of here. Who do you think you are, monster? This is not your place. This belongs to our empress. Get out, now." And at those angry words and threats, the monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more frightening. And that just even incited the security and the soldiers to even make more threats. "Get out now, or else." But every unkind word, every unkind deed, even unkind thoughts, the monster just got bigger and bigger and more frightening and more stinky. And when the empress came back after a wonderful, peaceful day at the Hong Kong University Center of Behavioral Studies, the monster was huge and was so frightening that even Steven Spielberg could not get anything as frightening as that in the movies. Not with all his digital effects. And the smell, the stench coming off this monster was so bad, really extremely bad, that even the maggots which were crawling on the monster's skin threw up, they vomited. Not even maggots can take that smell. So imagine how bad it would be. But the Empress, she'd been to the Hong Kong University Center of Behavioral Studies, so she was wise. She knew what to do. She took one look at that stinky, terrifying monster, and what did she do? "Welcome, monster. Thank you so much for coming to visit us. Has anyone got you something to drink yet? We've got a cup of tea," which reminds me. This is a good excuse to have a swig of tea. "We have many different flavours of tea. We have English breakfast. We have Earl Grey. We have, what's this one? This is Orange Pekoe? Ceylon tea. Very good for a Buddhist monk. For Theravada. I call this Theravada tea, because it's from Ceylon. The green tea I call Mahayana tea, because that's from China. Okay, does that make sense?" "Anyway, so we have peppermint tea, chamomile tea. What tea would you like?" And that was sincere kindness, that the monster just grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less threatening. And people eventually found out exactly what the problem was. All the security guards changed their attitude. They said, "Welcome, monster. Thank you so much for visiting us. Would you like something to eat? We have got oodles of noodles," because this is Hong Kong. we have what else do you like in this joint? "We dumplings. Would you like some dumplings? Or would you prefer some Western food? Because we can get you pizza. That comes in monster size. Monster pizza. Fit for a monster. What would you like?" So they rang out to get a monster size pizza for the monster. And somebody decided, "Well, look at the size of your feet. Have you ever had a foot massage?" reflexology. It's really rare for monsters to get foot massage. So had about a couple of dozen soldiers, such huge feet, gave them a foot massage. Have you ever had reflexology? Really nice. And the monster, oh, thank you so much. They were so kind to this monster that every kind act, word, also thought, the monster kept on shrinking, smaller and smaller and smaller. And soon the monster was so tiny that one more act, just one more act of kindness, and the monster vanished completely away, disappeared, shrunk into nothingness. And that's based on a story from the Buddha's teachings called the anger-eating monster. So what do you do? Get out of here, you don't belong. What happens? Gets bigger and more of a problem. Apparently, in Hong Kong, many bosses are anger-eating monsters. And they get worse. They say, boss, that's not appropriate. So you be kind to the boss. Oh, thank you, boss. Your bosses are here. Thank you for coming to see me. Thank you. And don't ever call your boss stupid. If you call your boss stupid, of course he's stupid. He hired you. If it was smart, I wouldn't have hired you, would it? Anyway, oh, just be kind to your boss. And then you see the anger just starts getting less and less and less and less and less. Okay, one of the stories, anecdotes. This, because sometimes people think, oh, this stuff doesn't work in real life. This is one of my students over in Sydney. She was a fashion business. And only starting from scratch, from herself, her little backyard, and doing really well. And then the contract with this big firm over in London to distribute her product, just taking her business to the next level. And so they were negotiating the contract backwards and forwards by phone and email. And of course the time came, we want to sign the contract. Come to London straight away. And she lived in Sydney. And she'd been coming a long time to my talks. So she had a little baby called Holly. And I called her Surya, because, you know, beautiful blonde hair, really nice cheeky smile. Surya means like sun. Sun is really nice. So, like sunshine. So, she had to leave Surya, little Holly, with her husband, and take the first available flight to Heathrow. You know how far that is. When she got there, she was jet-lagged, she was exhausted. All she said, all she had time to do was to go to the hotel, check in, have a shower, and then go straight to the boardroom to get this contract signed. It was worth it. But as soon as she came into the boardroom, the other director said, "You've wasted your time. You might as well go back to Sydney on the next flight. This CEO is just in a bad mood. There's no way he's going to sign any contract today. We know him, he's just full of anger and ill will." And she said, "Well, I've come all this way, I'm going to see him anyway." "Okay, suit yourself." So she went into a corner of the boardroom and she sat down, cross-legged on the floor, and began to meditate. Just quietly putting down all the bags of past and future. Just being kind to her mind, seeing her peaceometer, just relaxing to the max, just being really peaceful. And then the CEO came in. "Who's that? What's he doing in my boardroom? Who does he think she is?" He was really angry. He was a monster, just like the one who came into the Emperor's palace. And what did she do? She opened her eyes, as you do when you've been really relaxed in meditation, and she stood up and she walked towards the monster of the CEO without any fear, because she was really peaceful. And this CEO, which actually wasn't a CEO, he was a chief executive monster. And looks as if he's going to bite the whole head off. And this girl, Julie, she looked at him. She was totally relaxed because she'd been meditating. And she said this was not unpremeditated. The words just flew out of her mouth. She looked at this CEO. But she had this beautiful smile. He said, "You have such beautiful blue eyes, like my baby Holly back in Sydney." That's what she said to the CEO. Have you ever sort of been a CEO and had someone say that to you? You've got beautiful blue eyes. Maybe brown eyes or whatever eyes you've got. And the CEO, he'd never heard anything like that before. And it's like his brain just started fusing. He didn't know what to think next. It was totally just, you know, out of left field, unheard of. He didn't know how to respond. So it was this wonderful couple of moments when he was just totally this. The word for it, it's one of my favorite English words, it's discombobulated. You don't have to know what that means, but you need to sort of understand its main meaning. Totally confused. Because you know what the meaning of discombobulated is? That's exactly how he felt. He didn't know what it meant either. It was just something totally out of left field. So he was just so confused, and then in the space of 1 minute, he softened. And he smiled. He said, "Really? I've got beautiful blue eyes." And they had the contract signed with him within the next minute. And it's a true story. She told me this. She wouldn't lie to me. But then what happened next was really amazing. Was that the CEO, after signing the contract, just, you know, left for another appointment. And then she wanted to go back to her hotel to take a break, to take a rest. And she travelled all that way, and she was just exhausted. And the other directors would not let her leave. So they formed a circle around her. So we're not letting you go until you teach us how you did that. We never seen that before. So that's actually what happens with anger-eating monsters. Give them kindness. And then it's amazing just how everything starts to disappear and vanish. You have, what problems have you got in your life? Cancers? Get out of here, you don't belong. You're afraid. This is life-threatening. Oh, we're going to die one day anyway. Just, you know, as Mr. Bush used to say, bring it on. I shouldn't say that, Department of Behavioural Health. But anyway, have you ever found out? Oh, this, I got in trouble for this one as well. This story, this is a true story. This was one of my friends, his name was Ted. He was from Lancashire. And you know, in those days he would smoke because they didn't realise that smoking was going to be really bad for your health. So he got lung cancer. And eventually he was over in the hospice. You know, the hospice is, you know, just waiting to die. And you know, I went to visit him on the first night, and he told me what had happened. He said, the nurse, we were like a nurse, and you know, looking after him, I asked, you know, well, what do you want to eat tonight? He said, well, you know, I've got diabetes, so I can't have anything which is sugary. High cholesterol, so no fat, please. What else have I got? I've got sort of really sort of hardened blood vessels. I can't have anything salty. And the nurse looked at him and said, Ted, what on earth are you talking about? You're not going to die of a heart attack, of you know, hardened blood vessels or diabetes. You've got cancer. You've got about 6 or 7 days to live. You can eat whatever you want. Really? And so he ordered the oiliest, greasiest, saltiest, syrupy desserts he could possibly have. All the stuff his wife would never let him eat for years. And you know what happened? 6 days later, he walked out of the hospital. Remission. He went out for 6 months. Well, he actually did eventually die. Eventually, because I was there with him just before he died. You know what happened? This was, no, totally off the subject, but, you know, he was English, And so he was like under morphine and just hadn't sort of responded, just really struggled to breathe, as people do when they're passing away. I know what his last words were before he passed away. Because in English tradition, that sort of, you know, we share certain types of food at certain occasions, and it was coming close to my lunchtime. And after lunch, you know, from this time on, 12:30 onwards, that's a solar noon in Hong Kong, I can't eat until tomorrow morning. So what happened was, it was coming close to my lunch hour, so they knew they went and got whatever food they could get, which was actually some fast food. That's all they can get, just in a moment's notice. So it was his daughter, who was from Lancashire. She said, "Dad, would you like a chip?" And that was his last words. He opened his eyes and says, "Yes, please. He wants a chip." And then he died. That was his last words before he passed away. So even at lunchtime, where's Gerald? Gerald, you asked me to have a chip. So I had a chip as well today. It's English custom. But anyway, that was Ted. That was his last words before he passed away. So what do we call that? It's an interesting part of psychology. I've got a word for it now, which is called terminal lucidity. Well, you should actually know that. It's a fascinating part about the nature of the mind. Terminal lucidity. People who have been in comas, dementia, people who have been in morphine, so they haven't been able to communicate at all. The last 5 minutes, sometimes even longer, they become lucid. They can see you, hear you, talk to you. So many occasions of that, which is wonderful, just the nature of the mind and the brain. So how many of you have actually been with people who are dying who've actually shown terminal lucidity? You've seen that, yeah? Because it's amazing that happens. That even people keep on coming. Actually, Bob, yeah, I've experienced that as well. But this was even a doctor recently. He came up to me and said, "Yeah, it happened to me." He was an intern, and he got a message quickly from one of the nurses. One of his patients was dying faster than he expected. So he rushed to the bedside, checked, and the dying process had begun much more early than he'd anticipated. So she was in a coma, you know, because of morphine. And this fellow who was dying. And so, you know, he opened up the bedside drawer and had the telephone numbers, the contact numbers of the close family. And so, you know, he quickly as he possibly could started ringing the close family. "Come now, he's dying in the next hour. Come now." And he was on the phone to the daughter. It was actually also, maybe this is why I remembered it, her name was Julie, the daughter. Because he was following the daughter, "Come quick, your dad is dying." And he opened his eyes. He heard the name of his daughter, Julie, and said, "Please tell Julie how much I love her." And then he closed his eyes and died. His last words. So clear. That terminal lucidity, which is a fascinating part of human life. So anyway, I don't know why I got into that. But just like learning how to be, as we're going, how to be kind to even monsters, so eventually they disappear. Now that with health, you open the door of your heart to the monsters of life, and it's not allowing the monsters to walk all over you. It's actually the opposite happens. You find out the people don't become monsters anymore. It's a great way of dealing with even ill health or even mental health. I don't know, so I meet these people and push this out there, but don't really have too much time to do too much follow-ups. But I don't mind saying that the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore, when I gave a keynote address there at, I think it was about 30, 40, 50 years or something, anniversary of the opening of their complex, that was when sort of, I told all these stories, the same old stories, and the director of the schizophrenia department said, he said, can you please come and bless my unit? I said, yes, but I saw this huge cross on him. I said, you know, are you a Buddhist? He said, no, I'm a Catholic. Are you sure you want me to, you know, bless your unit? He said, yeah. I said, why? And he said, because I was impressed with the way you understood mental health. I'm the head of the schizophrenia unit. And I asked him, how do you treat schizophrenia in your unit? He was the professor, the big shot, the boss. And that's when he said, beautiful little way of expressing this, I do not treat schizophrenia in the schizophrenia unit of the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. And that was, yeah, this is interesting. When people see things in different ways, it opens up different avenues for healing. So, well, what do you do as a professor of schizophrenia in the schizophrenia unit of Singapore Mental Health Institute? He said, I treat the other part of the patient that is not schizophrenic. And I said, yes, that was awesome. That was one of the sadhu moments. Well done. And of course, you have to ask the question, even though it's quite obvious what the answer would be. What is the result? And I remember him saying, far better than conventional treatment. Amazing that when we see a problem, we amplify it, becomes big, we don't see the other part. You know, okay, this is classical Buddhist teaching, we're not supposed to be religious, but you know, everything has Buddha nature. Every boss has their soft spot. Even Mr. Trump. So you've got to find it first of all, it's in there somewhere. And if you can find that soft spot, the part which isn't schizophrenic, and work on that, the part of your body which is not cancerous, the part of your life which is not a mess, focus on that, and then you find amazing things happen. This is what mindfulness does. It opens up new avenues of looking at things. People are just so straight, so narrow-minded, literally. You know, they don't. And so I mentioned that Snoopy little bit of wisdom. You know, we'll all die one day. People assume, oh yeah, that's true. Yes, but, you can see it another way, but most days we don't die. Looking at the other part of things. So, when you look at it that way, it opens up new avenues of treatment, of transcending, of life, happiness, joy. Yeah, there are problems, there are bosses from hell. Yes, there are these terrible diseases. Yeah, there is some bird flu, but it's tweetable. Bird flu, tweetable. I really struggled, that was a bad joke. Bird flu. Birds go tweet, tweet. Okay. Okay, I'll look out the bad jokes. Every now and again you get a decent one. But, all of those little problems in life, sometimes changing the attitude towards them solves the problem. Not actually attacking the problem, but where you're looking at it from. So that's like what mindfulness does. It opens up new avenues of wisdom. Even like how to relax the body. Even actually understanding like just the peaceometer, how to be more peaceful. And so many people understand just how life in today's world is really, really busy. Is it? Am I busy? Have a look at page two of Happiness Every Day. And you see there is a quote, a definition of what a busy person is. A busy person is not someone who has a lot of things to do. A busy person is someone who does too many things at the same time. Have you ever seen that? Like high achievers. They do so much work. But it's as if they're doing no work at all. It just flows. Doing one thing at a time. Being here. Doing it. Rather than worrying about all this other stuff you have to do in life. Oh, if I worry about all the things which I have to do in life, I'll go crazy. All the next appointments, all the next things in my schedule. Actually, I think my organizer said, you know, I don't look at my schedule. That's why I keep going over time. I just let somebody else worry about that. I just sit here and enjoy myself. One thing at a time. So, that brings me on to the next little bit of meditation. And then we're going to do another... we can do a little bit of meditation again, because especially a bit of mindfulness, and then we can have a break. Yeah, that will work. We'll have the break first. No. Okay, if you need to have a break, please go. The letting go rooms, it's another form of meditation. We go there, it's having a glass of water meditation. Or it's having a tissue meditation. So, anyway, so... This is the type of meditation... Oh, yeah, don't do it yet. I haven't described it yet. People are just so in the future. So, so here, that how can we practice this type of meditation? Because some people say, oh, it's okay for you, Ajahn Brahm. You live in a monastery, you don't have much work to do. You don't have much responsibility. You don't have many worries. Okay, fair enough. But... one thing which I do know is just how to deal with whatever life presents to you. It's the attitude to life, not what you have to do in life. So, this is the type of meditation which is a brilliant meditation, because sometimes people, I'm tired, I'm sick, I'm really in pain, I can't meditate. And of course you can. Meditation is not what you are observing. It can be pain, it can be sleepiness, it can be the dying process, it can be being with a really tough boss. It's not what is in front of you which is important. It's how you relate to it. That is the essence of meditation. It's the relationship you have to the things which are thrown up in life, which you're presented to. It's how you deal with it, not what they are. So that was the great Emperor's Three Questions, meditation. And many of you should know by now the Emperor's Three Questions. It's not from Buddhist texts, it's not Christian texts, it's from Leo Tolstoy, who wrote a series of short... No, it was actually... He wrote one story in a book of short stories written in... This is Tsarist Russia... to support the Jewish community who were being quite discriminated against in Tsarist Russia, you know, when Tolstoy and Chekhov were quite well-known authors. And this is where I first read it, when I was at university. And it was a beautiful story, The Emperor's Three Questions. He was an emperor, it's very sort of good for our modern world, who'd had it up to here with religions. Always, who's right, who's wrong, promising things and just being a bit immoral or corrupt in the background. And he added up to here with religions, arguing with each other who's right, who's wrong. So being an emperor, he decided to invent his own religion. So all he really needed was, don't even call it a religion, a spirituality, something which he could use in his daily life, which would give life meaning. And he decided there's only three questions he needed the answer for. Number one, when is the most important time? Number two, who is the most important person? And number three, what is the most important thing to do? They become the Emperor's Three Questions. And what those of you who heard the story before, you know, it won't have as much impact as the first time you hear the story. When is the most important time? That's quite obvious. When is it? Now. So when is the time to say how much you love the person you share your life with? Don't put it off until tomorrow. Otherwise it never happens. You say it now. How much gratitude, how much you value the person you share your life with. Say, darling, I love you. I really do. Thank you for being my partner in life. If you put off until Valentine's Day or some other day, it just doesn't work. Do it now. And to forgiveness as well. When you've hurt somebody, now is the time to forgive and ask forgiveness. Don't wait till some other day. So now is the only time you ever have. So when is the best time to meditate? When's the worst time to meditate? Later. Now is the best time to say how much you appreciate someone you really care for. The worst time is later. So now is the most important time. So the second question, who's the most important person? That was the one which really shook me. Who's the most important person? Me? Yourself? Nah, both of those things are wrong. The most important person is the one right in front of you, whoever that happens to be. That was such an amazing answer, because that made sense to what I experienced in life. You know, have you ever been with somebody and they're trying to get rid of you? They're not listening. Now, hopefully, all of you who come up to me to take, not a selfie, a weefie, or sign a book, you know, even though you might be tired, oh, there's another book, I hope that I made you feel respected and important. You come up, and I've signed your book as best I possibly could to connect with you, give you importance, because the worst thing is, get away. Who do you think you are? Get out of here. I'm tired. Signed enough books. Yeah. Now that's really an awful attitude, because I was on the receiving end of that many times. You know, as a young student, you ask the lecturer, you know, just, you know, that's an interesting point, but I don't agree with it. He wasn't listening. He wanted to get rid of me as soon as possible. I was just a young, hairy student. He was some big professor. Have you ever had that experience? People are just too busy, and you're too unimportant. You know, sometimes that can be your husband, your wife. You need to say something to them. You come up and say, darling, say, oh, later, please. That's what destroys marriages. You're not respected. It's awful. So I try not to do that to anybody. Even you may be exhausted and tired. No, you're important. And the most important thing to do, that was a great one, it was to care. What do you mean by that? And that example was the story of another doctor story. This fellow who, known him since he was a little kid, kids like running around the temple. Sometimes people say, we should teach children meditation. I teach people kindness. So let them run around, make a mess, make a noise, and feel welcome. And later on, they can learn meditation later on. At least they feel welcome and cared for and not rejected. So anyway, so this young man, he was, again, first year as a doctor, done all that hard work. You know how hard it is to study all that much and just go through all those exams, and finally he was actually there treating people. And that's when he came up and said that he's going to resign. He came to ask me, first of all, because, you know, he respected me. And he said, I can't do this job any longer. Why? It was because one of his patients had passed away unexpectedly. And it was one of those tragic cases, which, you know, every now and again happens. Now, it was not his fault, but even it's not the doctor's fault, he still blamed himself. Well, maybe I should have seen this, maybe I should have seen that. And what really worst part of it was about a 23, 24-year-old woman in the prime of life, and he had to be the one to tell the husband, you know, the woman you committed to, the one you still love, it's no longer, I couldn't save her. It was unexpected, without warning. The husband never had a chance to prepare himself. And even worse, your two children have no mummy anymore. And that was such pain inside of him. He felt such a failure. And the consequences were just so hard to bear. And that's why he wanted to resign. And that was when, you know, the empathy questions that really came up and show how effective they are. I said, you've misunderstood the purpose of being a doctor, of being a psychologist, a psychiatrist, a nurse, a therapist, anyone in those professions. Your purpose is not to cure people. If that's your purpose, you will fail many times. Your main purpose is to care for people. If you make that your main priority, to care, then you never need to feel a failure. You can't cure diseases, not all of them. Even some of the psychological or psychiatric diseases. If you try and cure them, you find sometimes you go to extremes and you get frustrated. But you can always care for beings. You can always do that. I said, even if you know that you're caring for that patient and they pass away. They pass away knowing that they were cared for. And the family knew they were cared for to the max. That changes the whole experience. He got it straight away. He's back at work. And yeah, he's a great fellow. And, you know, he, every now and again, when somebody needs some help, especially one of my monks, still don't know the word. You know, they put something up your backside to see what's going on in your bowels. It's not an endoscopy, that's the other way, see. Anyway, just one of the monks was passing blood in his stool. They thought it might be bowel cancer. And so the public system there would be about 3 or 4 months before he got an appointment. So I think he'd be dead by then if it's bowel cancer. So he decided to go private. It cost a lot of money. We didn't go private. We just called in some karmic favours because the private doctor was this fellow I'd helped before. So as soon as he saw it was one of my monks, free. And I also got really much better care than if it was private or public. So, and he was a fellow who had cared for his patients instead of trying to cure them. And of course, you have a far greater cure rate if you care rather than try to cure. So that became so important. So if you've got a husband who's really giving you a hard time, stop trying to cure him. Care for him. If you've got a kid who's causing you strife, are you trying to change him? Trying to cure him to make him fit in to what a kid should be, whatever that happens to be? Or are you trying to care for him or her? You see the power when we change our attitude. There's a lot of kids. Richard Branson, he was dyslexic, numerically dyslexic. So, you know, he left school, became a billionaire. Was he the other people? Bill Gates was autistic. Or imagine if they were cured, they wouldn't be these geniuses. So a lot of these times, sometimes we don't recognize the beauty of the crooked trees. We go and the bent trees, the damaged trees, we try and cure them instead of caring for them. So anyway, that's the most important thing to do, to care. So what's that got to do with meditation? Mindfulness. It's so easy. How many of you, when you close your eyes, you think, oh, I should be watching my breath, I should be aware, I should be doing this, I should be doing that, instead of whatever's in front of your mind right now, whatever you're aware of in this moment is the most important thing in the world. You're restless, you're sleepy, you're just psychotic, whatever it is, why don't you just be with it? It's the most important thing in the world. And for goodness sake, don't try and cure it. Care for it. You've got a pain. Don't try and get rid of it. It's important. It's teaching you something. Hard to bear, but it's teaching you something about life. Care for it. Open the door of your heart to it. And what happens next will change the way you look at meditation. When you don't fight it, but you care for it, you get far greater results. So meditation becomes so simple. Anytime you can do this, close your eyes. This moment is the only moment you ever have in life. Just this moment. Whatever is in front of your mind right now is the most important thing in the world. Respect it. Acknowledge its presence. Even if you can't give it a name, leave it alone until you can understand it. And care for it. And that becomes the Emperor's Three Questions meditation. Very, very powerful. It's all you need to do. Anytime, any place, you can meditate. You get incredible results. So, the proof is in the practice. So, let's do... Should we have a break first of all? Okay. They're doing a nodding. This is a toilet break to care for your your bladder. So for those of you who want to have a toilet break for 15 minutes or so, try and come back in 15 minutes, and then we can do the Emperor's Three Questions meditation, and afterwards we have some bit of Q&A. Okay. So remember, the first person who gets to the toilet is the first one who gets into the cubicle. So we have the two girls are winning on the front, but she's taken over now. So it's a... Because, you know, I know you like horse racing. My money is on the lady in the red jacket to get in the first. And those of you who are not going to the toilet, you can just get up and have a stretch a little bit if you wish.
in case you have any questions to ask Ajahn, you're welcome to write something and put it in this basket. Thank you.
Okay. Those outside, I invite you to come in. Still in the toilet. Do they have like a PA system goes into the toilets as well? So people can actually listen in there. Very good. I don't know if you know this, but the research has found, you know where bees urinate? Where do bees urinate? They urinate in the BP petrol station. Okay, the BP station. Okay, I'll try something else while the other ones are coming in. About research in Australia. They found that, you know, there's, unfortunately, there's bird, like roadkill, the big heavy trucks going through the outback, and they noticed, really strange, the old theory was that crows, that they always get hit by the trucks, the lorries, but never by sedans. And so they decided to do some research from Darwin University into why that was the case. First of all, was it true or not? And so a group of students did a project and they did find, yes indeed, the crows will never get hit by a sedan, but by lorries, you know, so often. So once they established this was a fact, they wouldn't have found out why. And so after much more research, they found out the reason why was the crows would always work in pairs. And one of the crows would always be on a high tree as a lookout while the other one was on the road. And they noticed that the reason why the crows would only get hit by lorries and not by sedans was whenever they saw a car coming, the one up in the tree would always warn his friend by saying, "Car, car, car!" But they didn't know how to say, "Lorry, lorry, lorry." Okay, it's only just filling in while people come in. So anyway, yeah, they're coming, okay. Last ones. Okay, so now we can do a little bit of Three Noble Truths. No, not Three Noble Truths, the Three Episode Questions meditation. So, sit it out, and after 15 minutes, then we'll do some Q&A. Here we go, so sit down. It doesn't matter what your posture is. So posture means how you're sitting. Some people say you have to sit this way, you can't sit that way. That's fine, you know, if you're just a perfect young, healthy human being with no aches, no pains here, no injuries. But you know, for the rest of us, sometimes we've got sore backs, sore knees, sore this, sore something else. So because of that, you just sit as best you possibly can. Chairs are fine. Floor is fine. Leaning against the wall is fine. In fact, I'm surprised you've got a couple of nice armchairs over there. They're fine. They're not taken yet. I've already gone. Are you going to take one? No, no. Wherever you can be comfortable. So you sit down, close your eyes. First of all, just get a bit comfortable, the best you possibly can. And don't think that the last posture, the way you were sitting last time, was the best. Because you change every time. So find the position which you feel, as best you can, is the most comfortable. Then look at your peaceometer. How peaceful are you? How agitated are you? See what can make you more peaceful. Just letting go of past and future. Being kind to yourself. Allowing yourself to be a crooked, useless tree in the forest. You're good enough. And now. Now the only time you ever have. The future. It is a fantasy. It's a dream. You add so much onto it. And even the past. Psychology experiment after psychology experiment. Know how much we colour in the past. It's much more true to our what we think happened rather than what actually happened. So the only reality we can ever be sure of is this present moment now. So in this moment called now, what are you experiencing? No need to give it a name, just to know this moment. To be with it. To give it respect. It's a visitor who needs to be acknowledged, respected. You may learn something. If it's painful and unpleasant, it's harder to let them in. But it's much more effective to allow them to be. Now the most important time. Whatever you're experiencing right now is the most important. And the only thing to do is to care for it. To be kind. Just like if you were a small, unimportant, insignificant young student going up to these huge professors. This small, insignificant moment is coming up into your mind. Give it respect. Care for it. Let this moment be with kindness. Not trying to cure anything. Not trying to improve. That's looking into the future. Not getting angry. That's looking into the past. Instead, just being in this moment. Kind being here. Right now. Now the most important time. What you're experiencing now. Give it importance. And give it this beautiful kindness, opening the door of your heart to this moment.
as long as you're caring for this moment, can't do anything wrong. There's no failure when one cares. If you want something to happen, if you're trying to get things, of course there'll be disappointment sometimes. You can't always cure things. You can't always care for them. So what are you aware of right now? Be kind to it. Care for it. Ready. Just count three more breaths, in out, in out, in out, and the end of the third out breath. From now, open your eyes. Okay. So now we've got some questions. It's amazing this year. I've only got one question. I think there's more. Is there more outside? Yeah. Okay. Anyway, we got some more questions afterwards. Here we go. In your happy every day, you said compassion can't take off without wisdom. You also said we should read less, sleep less, eat less, etc. If happiness. So how do we develop our wisdom in order to give compassion, to help compassion? What we mean there is actually the kindness and compassion. You find that you may believe you're acting compassionately, but it's without the wisdom. It's not real compassion. So we start off with that body awareness, you know, feeling the body, and you think, oh, I'm going to be compassionate to this. Come on, relax, tummy ache, relax. How come you're not relaxing? In other words, it's not real compassion. It was fascinating for me that many people, they talk a lot about compassion, but they don't know compassion. They feel that they understand what real love is, but they don't. And it's weird that all these words, concepts, ideas, which we've been around for such a long time, we haven't truly understood. So even kindness, how do you understand what kindness, compassion is? It's that attitude which relaxes your body, which actually eases the mind, which opens things up, the kindness. And maybe some of the things where I learned kindness were from, and I obviously, like a mother's kindness is always powerful. When I was a kid, I did come from a council flat in London. I never realized at the time, but most of my friends were migrants, you know, poor people. And because my father was always quite sick. So that, let's just grow up like that. So that when we used to play soccer, it was in the street. And if you play soccer in the street, you go for a tackle and you end up scraping the skin off your knees. And so I'd always remember growing up with scabs on both knees. And that was just normal. But what I always remember was when, you know, you went for a tackle and you scraped the skin off and it started bleeding, you'd run to your mother, and my mother would kneel down and kiss it better. So just out of kindness, she would kiss the wound. And to me, at that time, immediately it would take all the pain away. And you wouldn't even not wash it. You just stick a plaster on it, a band-aid, and it would always heal. And to me, that was really weird. You took these things for granted. Now, a mouth full of germs on an open wound. I don't know how that works, but anyway, you know, how it took the pain away was amazing. That just one little act of kindness. And that's when I saw pain in my own body or pain in other people's bodies. Just realized it's the power of just a little bit of kindness and compassion, taking the pain away. That is where sort of I learned from the first the power of the kindness. It's what really relaxes and eases. What makes people be able to sit here in this room and not feel afraid, to feel safe, to feel accepted, to feel welcomed. So you relax. It's very powerful. When you do that, you can understand how you feel, how your body feels when it's relaxed. Thank you for coming to visit me, Chuma. Thank you for coming to visit me. So back pain, knee pain. You take away a lot of the fear and then healing can happen. So this is where you learn what compassion truly is and how powerful it is. So we know it's compassion by its effect. If it's the wrong type of compassion,
just like a love which expects something out of something else, then of course it never works. That's how I find what real compassion is. Not what you read in books. Not what you hear from monks like me. But how you learn from yourself, from your own life's experience. You feel it, you're aware. That's what mindfulness does. You become like aware of how your body's working inside. Not how it's supposed to work, but how it does work. And you know, what compassion is, how to relax. Such a weird thing that many people in this world do not know how to relax. You have a holiday, what do? Go shopping, check your messages on iPhones. Can you just stop that for a few minutes? As somebody said, well, what's the difference? Yeah, I'll tell you what the difference is. Many of you watch me on Friday night on YouTube. So why do you come here? What's the difference? Live, personal, real, has a totally different quality than if you see something on YouTube. That is why the screens cannot replace real life. You have some sort of rock star, you pay hundreds, thousands of dollars to go and get a front seat to watch them. What do you want to do that for? You can see them on the movies. On the TV, a live performance on TV, you know, in high definition, surround sound. Probably have a hologram of them soon. But it never actually replaces actually being there. So that's one of the reasons why just if something else happens when it's face to face. Which is one of the reasons why you learn what compassion is by your experience. Not by what you see on the screen or read on a book. Even being a doctor, many doctors have said this, and of course it's a dangerous thing to say, but sometimes when they're with one of the people they're caring for, sometimes they have to forget, deliberately forget everything they've ever been taught. All the shoulds, all the usual procedures to be able to feel and know something which is more true than what you've ever read in a book. I know some doctors who do that, and won't tell their names because sometimes you get big trouble for that, but they have amazing results. Go up to a patient's bedside. Don't even take the temperature or whatever, they know what to do. Just the intuition, the insight, the feeling, something which is way beyond the books. That is powerful. And that works. So sometimes that's what compassion is. Wisdom is not what you study. Never allow your learning to stand in the way of truth. You understand that? All your learning of what it's supposed to do. We always want these experts to tell us. But really, what are the experts telling us? Just like modern schooling, you don't tell people facts. Teach them how to find out for themselves. Teach them to know how the body and mind works. What is compassion? What is kindness? Have you ever felt kindness? Of course you have. You feel it. You know this is kind. And you know it just relaxes and changes so much of the situation around you when it's really genuine acts of caring. When somebody asked me earlier, what is the meaning of life? You see that every time you see a beautiful, kind act. It gives beauty and joy, it gives meaning to life. And caring, of course, is not about me. It's not about I. That's why, no selfies. Weefies. We're in it together. That is making a point. It's not just a joke. There's a point to that.
Weefies. Okay. Any other nice questions you have? Yes. It is a huge source of wisdom as well as happiness. And one of the just when I was in Bangkok just a couple of weeks ago, there was a fellow, he was a top neuroscientist. He just recently retired. And I forget what his name was now, but he gave me his, he didn't have a card, but I was telling sort of first a few funny stories to, he was one of the senior monks in Thailand, one of the six somdets they call them. And he'd just been to the town of Surabaya, you know, in southern Java. Southern Java, or you might say eastern Java, southeast Java. But the port of Surabaya. You know Surabaya? I said, do you know what Surabaya means? Because this is, you know, Buddhists who are trying to keep the precepts. It's because abaya, it means like fear. And so sura is a word for liquor. I said, what that means is be afraid of liquor. It doesn't mean that. It's just, you know, joking around. But, you know, that everyone thought that was very funny. And so this fellow said, yeah, you know, that's the sign of higher brain function, is laughing. And there was even a neuroscientist saying that. That's so true. The only people you see who don't laugh are dead people. So I think that's actually what you should actually do to you know, because doctors have a hard time finding out who's dead, who's not dead. You know, you can put sort of lights in their eyes and sometimes it moves and shout in their ears or whether they're brain dead or what. But that's my fight, to see if someone's really dead. Whether they can laugh at a funny joke. Otherwise, you're as good as dead. You're like The Walking Dead. There's a high brain function. So, I'm laughing at life. So it's good if there's, and I'm not the only monk who laughed. Sometimes Ajahn Chah, some of the stories he told were just really, really funny, really made everybody laugh. A bit gross, but you know, he was the one who told me the chicken and the duck story. You know that one? How many people don't know the chicken and duck story? Okay, this is funny, but it has saved many marriages. Honestly. So, there was a couple who had just been married, and after a few days of marriage, they were having a walk in the park one lovely afternoon, where they heard the sound, quack, 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 quack. And she told her husband, oh, darling, can you hear that? That's a chicken. And he said, that is not a chicken, that's the duck. She said, no, I'm sure that was a chicken. He said, it can't be a chicken, that was a duck. And it went quack, quack again, that's a duck. She said, no, I'm sure that's a chicken. He said, it can't be, it's a duck. It's a chicken, it's a duck, it's a chicken, it's a duck. D-U-C-K, duck. The chicken. And she was about to burst into tears, and then he looked into her eyes and realized why he married her. He squeezed her hand gently and said, darling, I think you may be right. That's a chicken. And she said, oh, thank you, darling. And they carried on their walk without any argument, in love. And he had a wonderful dinner, a lovely evening with his wife. And the meaning of that story should be obvious. Who cares whether it's a chicken or a duck? Is that grounds for a divorce?
it's not even grounds for a sort of, you know, a sort of an argument. And number two, just because it goes quack quack does not mean it's a duck. I've got proof, I've got evidence. Somebody downloaded this and sent it to me from the internet that there was a little duckling who was orphaned. And it was brought up by a chicken. And it goes quack quack. It is a chicken. So it was a chicklet. What is it called? Not chicklet. Chick. A chick. Yeah, okay. A chick was actually brought up by a duck. It was orphan chick. And so the little chick followed the other little ducklings and just followed their lead. And it's a chicken, but it actually goes quack quack. That's what it learned. So there is at least one chicken who goes quack quack. And the moral of that story is, okay, doesn't matter having an argument and how many times you've been right or thought you were right and it turned out you were wrong. Why do people always have to be right? There's nothing bad about being wrong. I really enjoy it when I make mistakes, when I'm wrong. Like, and it's actually, if you use it correctly, you can make a lot of money from being wrong. Like this case, it was a retreat which I was given in Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia. And the retreat time, we had these interviews. So this young woman came in with a man, and so I was interviewing them. And then after, you know, they finished interviewing, they said, "Oh, why doesn't your husband say anything?" And both of them burst out laughing. He said, "He's not my husband. He's my father. I'm only 16. And I said, "Wow, only 16? You know, you look like about 25. And then looked at her father and said, "Wow, you only look about 30. And you know, they were so impressed at my mistake. Because you know what sort of 16-year-old girls would like? If you tell them they look about 25 or 23, wow, they're really impressed. And a man, even more so, if it was about 44, 45, when I said, "Oh, you only look about 30, he was doubly impressed. So they burst out laughing. They said, "Thank you, thank you, thank you." And they went outside and they came back 5 minutes later with an ang pao with $100 Australian with a little note saying, "Please use some of this donation to check on your prescription for your glasses." That came from my mistake. There's nothing wrong with making mistakes. So you just give it a try and see what happens. Because then you're a bent tree, like everybody else. Crooked, making mistakes in life. You don't have to be better. You don't have to be perfect. You don't always have to be always right. Isn't that beautiful? Takes all the pressure off. Anyone else got any questions, comments? Yes. Okay, oh yeah, I'm supposed to do the microphone thing.
When we are practicing mindfulness, will wisdom come naturally? And how does this happen? Thank you, Ajahn.
Yes, it comes naturally. Because when you're practicing these types of meditation, you find you become relaxed. When you relax, you become still. You become like the lake in a forest. A lake in the forest. I'm going to say a lake in the mountains. It's a much better simile. A lake in the mountains, if there is any waves on the surface, it will never give a true reflection of the moon and the stars in the sky above. Even if there's ripples on the surface of that lake, it distorts the image. But if your lake is perfectly still, it acts like a mirror and gives a beautiful, accurate, perfect reflection of the moon and the stars in the sky above. So what compassion, metta, does, it creates stillness. And it's from the stillness where wisdom arises. I've even titles of books about that, Wisdom Born of Stillness. That's where wisdom comes from. Compassion, kindness, it creates the stillness. The peace. You can't change the world. You sure can change the attitude towards it and create some peace. And from that peace, you get the wisdom. So that's how it works. Any other comments or questions? Or stories? Yeah, go on. It's when they have to do something, it becomes impossible. When you have to just say, now is the most important time. The thought in front of you is the most important thing in the world. Don't try and cure your mind. Because trying to cure your mind is saying there's something wrong with you. Saying that you're a failure, you're deficient, you're not good enough. And if people do that, then they find they want to run away. Why do people have addictions? Addiction to gambling, addiction to watching porn, addiction to the iPhones. What are they running away from? They're running away from themselves. They're trying to escape. Why? Because somewhere, sometimes they think they're not good enough. They just can't be. They've got to be going somewhere, running away somewhere, doing something, instead of just being. And so that's one of the reasons I'm very against the self-help movement, trying to improve yourself. Like the person who went to the bookshop looking for a self-help section, they went to the receptionist and said, where is the books on self-help? The receptionist said, if I told you that, it would defeat the purpose. At least somebody's laughing over there. They're alive over there. They're dead on this side. That's much better. Thank you for laughing. So, whole idea of improving. What's wrong with you? You know, there was a time when, like, the gay community were considered to be something wrong with them. And people wanted to try and cure that. And how terrible that was. How people who were different, were put in institutions, hidden away from the rest of humanity. And it was wonderful that these days, that if you may have Down syndrome, even schizophrenia, ADD, whatever that is, people who have said you like this, you like that, they're actually put in inter-community. You grow up with people of all different types and you get to respect one another, love one another and live with one another. And it's a wonderful thing which I've seen in my lifetime with people like with Down syndrome. They're part of everything. And when they're accepted in, I learned so much from Down syndrome, you know, just volunteering and seeing the huge emotional intelligence of people who they couldn't go to school. I was at university and I went to some people with Down syndrome. They knew straight away, as I often say, that when you've broken up with a girlfriend, they knew straight away. And they were just, oh, that blew me away. How do you know that? They come up to me and give me a hug. Number one, I was English. I was heterosexual. Being hugged in public by a guy, it was a very difficult thing for an English young man to do. But they did this. And how did you know? And how did you know what I needed? And they were just so smart. Why are we putting people like this in an institution to think there's something wrong with them? There's more things wrong with those professors I used to hang out with. Honestly, sorry, any professors here. But, so when you have people involved, it's amazing.
And I don't know who it was. It could have been from someone in Hong Kong recently at a retreat. Although they had one of their relations was a clinical schizophrenic, and they were asking me for some advice. And one of the monks just happened to go into the office, and I said, "See that monk over there? He's a clinical schizophrenic."
What?
He is. He's one amazing monk. And you wouldn't know. Totally accepted, wise, embracing sort of that disease. We call it disease. Sometimes I think that, you know, what I once thought was a disability was an enhancement. You know, he has some wisdom I will never have. So it's amazing that when we can embrace some of these things rather than improving them. So please never try and improve your wife. Care for her. Your kid. Don't try and make him fit in to what a kid should be. Just love him for who he is. And just see him blossom in his own way. Who knows where he will go. What she would achieve in life. Maybe totally different than others. Unique, special, valuable. See where they grow. Don't always push them in the same way through university and has to get married and just, you know, has to be successful in life. Look at me. I've got no income, no savings. Well, that's nice when you actually just change just how you can respect and love and care for a person. Well, this is, it challenges, see things in a different way. That's one of the great things which about the monastic life, you had time to go on retreats, time just to relax and time to see things in a different way. Think outside the box because you live outside the box. Wonderful thing to do. Talking about thinking outside the box, there was one of our disciples, known her for a long time. We did her funeral service just before I left. She really was thinking outside the box. She didn't even have a casket, cardboard box. So that was, she was buried in a cardboard box. Environmentally, much more sensitive. There's a shortage of wood. Why do we make these expensive caskets, coffins, out of a piece of wood and then burn it? Or bury it? What is that for? It's hard to get. This is really top quality wood as well. So why do you do that? Wouldn't it be better to use a biodegradable cardboard? Is that being... But people think, oh no, that's not being respectful. This is my father and my mother. They only die once, so let's give her the very best. But of course they don't die once. We're Buddhists. So, you know, you're only temporary. So being a Buddhist, I'm a born-again Buddhist. Many, many times. So anyway, it is literally thinking outside the box. The only people who shouldn't think outside the box, I've got a cartoon of this, is this gentleman staring at his cat. Cat, I'm pointing to the litter box, don't ever think outside the box. So this is that. Okay, here we got another. How many psychiatrists or psychologists have we got here today? Do you know about the psychologist? And a squirrel came to the consulting rooms. And the psychologist said, "What are you doing here? You're a squirrel." And the squirrel said, "Yes, well, ever since I realized you are what you eat, I realized I was nuts." You are what you eat, so you're nuts. Okay. And somebody got it in the back after a while. So, and humour is also important
because it takes away the sense of ego and self. Because we always laugh together. You can't laugh alone. It joins people together. And little things. I remember at a conference for young people. And to make it interesting, instead of teaching them stuff which wasn't important to them, I split the group into two. And, you know, men and women. They're 15 to 25 year olds. Many things we did there. But one of the things was I asked the men, first of all. And the girls had to be quiet. And the guys, what do you like in a guy? No, so the girls were quiet. So I asked the guys, what really attracts you to a woman? What type of woman would you like to go out with and commit to? And I asked the guys that question. You know, all the girls were just listening intently. Because no one had ever told them what they needed to do to be get an attractive, good guy. Have you ever been taught that in school or university? How to be attractive? How to get a nice partner in life? So all the girls were really listening. And what the guys were saying, said, you know, they don't have to be drop-dead gorgeous. They don't have to, you know, have expensive, sexy clothes. I want to go out with someone who's trustworthy, who turns up on time, who's clean, presentable, fun to be with, someone I can enjoy my time with together with. Yeah, being attractive, you know, it gives that first, you know, at least he's a nice looking guy. But that was not most of it. It was just being kind, trustworthy. I'm getting the genders mixed around now. When I asked the others, okay, that was the boys saying what they wanted in a girl, and then the girls, what they wanted in a boy. So you don't have to be just a tough guy, you know, and just be the Bruce Willis. I'm really tough. You don't have to be macho and show off like that. You want, again, somebody who's fun to be with, who's kind. Especially the kindness. That was way up there in attractiveness. And this is what they were saying. It was a wonderful thing to learn, because a lot of times, you know, we think to have a partner in life, you know, we have to be strong and tough and have be like Arnie Schwarzenegger and just really, you know, big abs. And just, obviously, to be clean and presentable and well-groomed, yeah. But you don't need to be just this big, tough guy. You don't need to be this drop-dead, gorgeous girl. You need to be kind to one another. To care for one another. To trust, be trustworthy. To be on time. Little things like that. It was amazing. Just, these are all the things which we're teaching. We can't just, you know, make, you know, somebody into, well, you can go to all these facelifts, boob jobs, facial plastic surgery, just hair implants, wigs. And sometimes people say, Ajahn Brahm, you don't live in the real world. Come off it. I don't dye my hair. I don't wear makeup. I don't wear padded bras. Who lives in the real world and who doesn't live in the real world? But anyway, so the most important thing is actually there's this smile, this happiness, this joy, this trustworthiness, this kindness. What the Buddhist Davidson used to call, Daniel Goleman, the emotional intelligence. It's far more a predictor of success in life than your IQ and your university degrees. The emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence includes things like kindness, making peace with things, learning how to work wisely, not force. So, at all similarly, again, it's amazing how this goes around, because somebody sent me, it's actually Burr found on the internet, a professor of psychology came into the university holding a cup, and people were thinking, oh, they're going to say about half full, half empty. He said, no. He said, how heavy is the cup? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. It's my old story. I say this every year. I haven't said it yet in this joint. But how heavy is the cup? The longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. After 2 minutes, I'm in pain. 3 minutes in agony. Stupid monk, what should I do when it starts to get too heavy to hold comfortably? Put it down for a few minutes. Relax. Rest. And then afterwards you pick it up again. Yeah, honestly, it feels lighter. Because your arm is rested. And he said, that is the meaning of stress. And how to overcome stress. It's not lessening your workload. It's not trying to downsize. Look at me, I've been upsizing, not downsizing. No, it's... The reason I get like this is because I don't worry enough. Apparently worrying, sort of, you know, you waste a lot of energy, but I should worry some more. Give me something to worry about, please. No! You know what happened when I went to the United States? So they're really looking at sort of homeland security now. So I go walking through the customs, immigration, security, and they say, sir, what have you got under your rope here? Because they thought it could be a suicide belt. So I said, no, it's not a suicide belt, it's only fat. They said, same thing. Okay, anyway, maybe you get that joke, maybe you don't. Anyway. Anyway, just learning how to let go of things, put it down. So that means when you rest, then you become efficient. Success in life is not how long you work, how efficiently you work. You are productivity. So, relaxing, resting, afterwards you get 3 hours work done in two, according to Harvard Business School, who's also taken on board that teaching. You relax, you rest, and then when you go back to work afterwards, you're clear. People don't know how to rest. So what we're teaching here with mindfulness and meditation is how to rest, how to let go. Don't worry about things. Just let the past go, let the future go, and just have a nice quiet time. And if you say, well, I can't find a quiet place to have a quiet time, restroom. Why is it called restroom? There's a reason for that. Take a rest. And if your boss says, well, you've been in there for a quarter of an hour, 20 minutes. Say, well, I've been constipated. You're not lying. Not down here, you've been constipated up here. So you just got to let go. Okay. Well, I've gone over time. That means I get overtime?
That means it's time to sadhu.
Okay. 1, 2, 3. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm.
Very good.
Just to let you know, this is only the first event of Ajahn Brahm being in Hong Kong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You come first.
So please check our website, bodhiana.com, for other events. Tomorrow we will have evening talk at Poly University. There'll be lots of people over there. Yeah. With Chinese translation too.
Okay.
Yes, please check the website. Thank you.
Very good. So take care, everyone. Don't do anything I wouldn't do. Have a good night. You don't want to go? Okay. Thank you for coming, everybody, and take care.
Someone a scarf upstairs earlier. Not sure if, is there anyone? Ah, okay, okay.